Well, good morning. It's good to see you all here today. It's good also to see some guests in our midst. We're glad that you've come. If you were expecting me to begin preaching on Acts today, it's my apologies. I'm not actually going to start on Acts today. The reason I thought I was is because I thought it was Pentecost this Sunday. I read the liturgical calendar wrong, and so when I planned, I thought, hey, I'm going to start with Acts when we do Pentecost. So it's actually not Pentecost today, so I want to finish off the series that we began after Easter, which is looking at the question, Jesus said that all the scriptures said the Messiah, that is himself, had to suffer, die, and rise again. There is nowhere in the Old Testament that you could point to one text and say, see, it foretold it, it prophesied that it was exactly going to turn out this way. So we've been looking at the question, how does Israel's scriptures, that is what we call the Old Testament, foretell and forecast that this Christ did have to suffer, die, and rise again? So I'm going to conclude the series this morning. We're going to go back to the text we looked at 2 weeks ago. I'm getting a lot of reverb here. Can we maybe try and, that's awesome. That's perfect. Thank you a lot. So if you want to turn in your Bibles to Exodus 16, we're going to read from verse 37 to 17, chapter 7. Actually, I'm going to start at verse 35, not verse 37, because there is no verse 37. All right. This is a typo. So within context, you'll remember that God has delivered Israel out of Egypt. They come to the Red Sea. Pharaoh and his army are breathing down their necks. God splits the Red Sea. Israel comes through, and then they're brought into the desert where they suffer various forms of deprivation. This is the second time they suffer the deprivation of a lack of water. And we read these words. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. And then an omer is 1/10 of an ephah. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Walk on ahead of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It's an ancient statement, and many people have agreed with it, especially Buddhists, actually. Namely, the statement that life is suffering. Life is suffering. And while the Christian might want to qualify this statement a little bit by saying that while there's a lot of suffering in the world, life isn't entirely and only suffering, the Christian will nonetheless agree with the thrust and the intent of the statement, which is to say, you know what, there is a boatload of suffering that goes on in this world. This world can be an agonizing, tragic place to be. As we look at the world today, it's not hard to see that. When we look at what's going on and see what happened to Egyptian Christians this past week, to see what happened at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, we don't even have to look out that far. We have had 3 deaths in this congregation within the last 4 weeks. We've had 5 since November. That's not to mention all of the other silent suffering going on in this body of Christ. Those things that you have shared and many of the things that you have not shared. I got a telephone call from somebody outside of this church, a friend of mine whom I had been trying to contact for 2 months. I knew they were getting my texts, I knew they were getting my telephone calls, but they weren't replying to them, and I was getting frustrated. And finally, this friend of mine picked up the phone, and I said, "Dude, you're completely baffling me. Like, why aren't you picking?" He said, "Please don't be baffled." And then he proceeded to explain to me how his life has become an absolute mess once again, going through relational difficulties that tear out the heart. And I just listened. And remembered again, life can be so unbelievably hard, and the things that people can go through can make us say, indeed, yeah, it's almost entirely true that life is suffering. There is arguably no people group in the world that knows the truth about that statement more than the Jews do. Within recent memory, it's a couple of blinks ago that the Jews suffered the Holocaust. Millions were tortured, millions were starved, millions were killed. We know the story well. Some are suggesting that another round of anti-Semitism is showing its ugly face in our world today. And even within our text itself, don't you find this absolutely remarkable? 400 years in slavery in Egypt, suffering, oppressed by Pharaoh, God delivers them out of Egypt. And then they come to four crises in rapid succession. First, they come to the waters of the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army running down behind them, breathing down their back. Can you imagine the psychological terror that you would feel as your children are clinging to your legs and an army is running after you? That is suffering. God delivers them through the Red Sea, and then they're brought into the Egyptian desert, which is like hell on earth. It can be 48 degrees Celsius in the desert. And then they're put into a predicament of deprivation. They have no water. That's like hell on earth. That is physical suffering in its worst. The water's bitter. It can't be drunk. And then they come into another crisis where there's no food. And then they come into a water problem again where there's no water at all. That's the text before us this morning. And immediately after our text, if you read the next passage, you'll see that they come into yet a fifth crisis from the moment that God has delivered them out of Egypt. Namely, they are faced by a ferocious band who wants to kill them. And Israel's men, who've never fought in battle before, have to now suddenly engage in battle. Isn't it remarkable? And have you ever looked at the text that way? They suffer 400 years, they're redeemed from suffering, and then it's suffering, 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 suffering. And I don't think it's unfair for us to ask why, actually. And I don't think it's unfair for us to look for some application for our own lives, because some of you in your Christian life or in your life just generally have experienced that. You've come out of one context of suffering only to enter into more contexts of suffering. And it can happen in the Christian life, and it does. And it makes you kind of wonder why. And I think looking at this story and seeking an answer to this question from the perspective of Israel can shed light on our own experience. So let's do that. Why would God deliver Israel from Egypt and suffering only to bring them into more contexts of suffering? Why would God do that? Is there any sense that can be made of this question at all? I think in order to start to get a grip on this question, to start to nudge toward some forms of answers, and I don't think we're going to be able to get absolute answers today, but I think we can get some hints and move towards some suggestive ground. I think one of the ways to do it is to first of all just back up and widen the camera angle a little bit and ask the question, why did God elect Israel in the world in the first place? The answer to that question, this might be put in a variety of different ways, but the foundational answer to that question in the Old Testament is that God elected Israel through Abraham in order to deal with the problem of suffering. That's why he elected Israel, to deal with the problem of suffering in the world, to take it out of circulation. Or to put it positively, they were to be his agents of renewal and healing in the world, dealing with the problem of sin and all of the various forms of suffering that come about as a result of sin. Okay, so that's Israel's vocation, that's Israel's mission in the world. Now, why would God take them out of suffering only to lead them into more suffering? There's two things I think that we can say here. The first one's general, the second one's a little bit more specific. In the first place, if Israel is to fulfill its vocation, its mission of taking suffering out of circulation in the world, then Israel must understand suffering. As a first order of business, this is just a very simple point to be made here. Maybe you've seen it yourself. It is those who have tended to experience suffering, who understand suffering, and who develop a heart to help others who are suffering. It's just a basic human reality. If you've suffered, if you've really gone through suffering, and it hasn't completely made you bitter and angry about the world, it can make you soft, and it can open your eyes to those who are suffering around you. It never ceases to amaze me, for example, when I talk to fellow pastors, why they got into the ministry. Almost without exception, including my own story, there has been a moment of extreme suffering where they learned, where they hit rock bottom, and they learned that the rock at the bottom is Christ. And that gave them a heart for other people and wanting to alleviate, to relieve some of the suffering of this world. Almost every pastor I know has gone through that. And this is true in other areas too, isn't it? Like, why is it that the person who tends to lead divorce care is the person who's gone through a divorce? Why is it that when my father was going through heart surgery, the people that were coming in to visit him before his surgery, and probably the worst part is not the surgery itself, but the emotional anticipation of going through a quadruple or more bypass. Why is it that the people who came are those who'd already been through it? Seems to be that way. Why is it that when somebody suffers from bad thinking and they get sucked into a cult, that it's that person who goes on to get a PhD to figure out how to think pretty well so that they can protect other people from also being get sucked into cults? It's because generally it's just true. Those who have suffered understand suffering and feel compassion and want to help other people who are suffering. And I think it's entirely fair to say that one of the reasons that God might have allowed Israel to suffer for 400 years in slavery in Egypt as a people was so that they could understand suffering, and in the first instance, of what it means to be marginalized, of what it means to be poor, of what it means to be downtrodden, so that when they came into the land of milk and honey, they too would be a people with a heart for other people. And why am I fairly confident in, you know, kind of throwing out this suggestion? Well, because when you get to a book like Deuteronomy, God says explicitly to Israel, Israel, when you get into the land and when things get good for you, don't forget what I brought you through. Remember how you suffered? Remember how you were the least, the last, the lonely? Remember how you were oppressed and marginalized? When you see the widow, when you see the orphan, when you see the stranger, when you see the alien, you are to do to them what I did for you. Restore them, dignify them, help them, show them the compassion of God himself. That, I believe, is the first reason why God allows Israel to suffer, so that they will be a people who care about suffering in the world. So just one word of application here. If you're going through suffering right now and you can't get out of it, you've tried, you can't get out of it, it's beyond your power to get out of it right now. Maybe one of the things to do there is to ask God to empower you to re-envision your suffering so that you might learn from it and to say, okay, God, I'm going through this right now. I want it to end, but it's not ending. So here's my prayer. Give me a heart so that I can alleviate other people who are going through the same thing that I am. Alleviate their pain and their suffering. That is one prayer we can pray. I think there's a second reason why Israel is allowed to suffer, say, something like this deprivation just after they come out through the Red Sea. That is this. If Israel is to fulfill its vocation to alleviate suffering in the world, then Israel will not only need to have compassion for those who suffer. Compassion is important. But Israel is also going to have extraordinary wisdom about suffering itself. They need compassion, but they also need wisdom. If they don't have wisdom, their compassion might be for naught. Here's how it works. As all of us in this sanctuary this morning know, there are different kinds of suffering, right? There's different kinds of suffering. You can have physical suffering because you've stubbed your toe or because you've just given childbirth. But then you can also have emotional suffering because you've had a relationship that has gone south, or you've got tormented relationships in your family of origin or whatever. Some forms of the suffering are greater than other forms of suffering. Some of these forms of suffering are a greater threat to your overall well-being than other forms of suffering. A stubbed toe is one thing, but seeing your spouse walk out the door is entirely another thing to endure completely. Now, the wise person will seek not to alleviate the lesser suffering if it means opening the door to the greater suffering. Okay, if you can only choose one form of suffering to alleviate, the wise person isn't going to seek to alleviate the lesser form of suffering and open the floodgate for the greater suffering to come in. The wise person is going to do that which is best for the whole person. So for example, just on a pure physical level, doctors and nurses and firemen do this all the time, don't they? They come to a patient and the patient has, let's just go with the stubbed toe again, a stubbed toe and an obstruction in their throat that's asphyxiating them. The wise doctor or nurse or fireman doesn't go and bandage the toe before dealing with the obstruction. That would be the apex of folly. It would not be wise. But instead, they deal with the greater threat to the person's life, and then they deal with the lesser threat to the person's life. The problem with humanity is that we don't get this. It's easy in an example like that, right? Obviously deal with the obstruction in the throat. But the problem is that when it comes to other things in our life, we don't tend to exhibit this wisdom as human beings. There was a movie that was launched in the early 1990s. I don't recommend watching it. It's a pretty harrowing movie called Indecent Proposal. The only reason I went to see it when I was in my teens at that time was because there was a dollar theater in New West, I remember, so we just went and watched whatever was there. It didn't matter. Anyways, it featured Demi Moore and Woody Harrelson and Robert Redford. Woody Harrelson's character and Demi Moore were a married couple, and she was an architect and he was an engineer. They were very well-to-do, and they went and they bought a beautiful house together, and it was gorgeous, and then the recession hit, and they were in financial straits, and they were going to lose their house. So they figured the way to solve this was to go to Vegas, and they would gamble. And they were, you know, Woody was a good gambler, so they were going to win the money back kind of thing. Well, as it turns out, they lose all of the money, everything. They have absolutely nothing. They're in a state of material deprivation, as bad as it gets. Then there's Robert Redford. Demi Moore is absolutely stunningly beautiful, and he sees her from across the room, and he comes and befriends the couple, and he finds out the situation that he's in, and then he makes his indecent proposal. And the indecent proposal is one night with your wife, and I'll give you $1 million. Demi and Woody go away, and they talk about it. They're like, one night, it's just a physical act, it's only one night, and we'll be good. Forever. Like, we'll be good. A million bucks in the late 90s was still a lot of money, you know. So we're going to be in great shape. So she goes off, and then Woody's at home alone, and it becomes dark, and he realizes what he's done. He has sacrificed the greater in order to alleviate the lesser. He's willing to alleviate their material problem in exchange for emotional well-being and wholeness with his wife, and he goes berserk. And it makes you cry when you watch this, because he goes wild and he tries to stop and he can't find him. And then the rest of the movie is basically working out this fundamental principle. Do not ever do that. Don't do it. It's not worth it. It's never worth it. It's like Esau, right? Selling his birthright for a mess of pottage. Don't do that. The problem with Israel and what we see in the text is God's trying to teach them. Don't sacrifice the greater need for the lesser need. Your greater appetite and source of life for the lesser appetite and source of life. Yeah, you're hungry. I get hunger. But you have a need for God. And what Israel does in our text is they sacrifice their relationship with God and a trusting relationship with him in order to fill their stomachs. As we see in the text, they're about ready to kill Moses. They do not cry out to God. And I think there's a juxtaposition going on in the text there. Because the first thing Moses does, it's not that physical hunger is bad. God wants to feed you. He wants to feed us. But Moses cries out to God first instead of cutting off the relationship with God. And this is what Israel does. And the problem is, throughout Israel's history, Israel continues to repeat and recapitulate the same error. They will satisfy a lesser appetite while sacrificing the greater. And in this instance, it is the greatest appetite and greatest need of all, because God is the source of life, as he demonstrates in this text so magisteriously, right? Water doesn't come from rocks, as I said 2 weeks ago. And that's exactly the point. God can make life come for you out of anything. So trust the source of life instead of your own ability to get it for yourself in other ways. We have to trust the source of life. Israel fails miserably throughout their history at this. And what's the lump sum consequence? Well, the lump sum consequence is that Israel does not fulfill their vocation in the world. Instead of taking evil and suffering out of circulation, they actually add to the aggregate evil and suffering in the world. They increase it. They add to it. Until, that is, yes, until Jesus comes. Until Jesus comes. Jesus is the embodiment of Israel. Have you ever wondered, for example, why there was 12 apostles? The reason that Jesus selects 12 and only 12 and exactly 12 disciples to be his apostles is not because he didn't have more people who followed him. He did, right? But it was 12 because he was reconstituting the people of Israel around himself. Here is God's new means of taking suffering out of the world, bringing healing to the world. So what do we see Jesus doing throughout his life? Well, it's rather remarkable, right? You could almost summarize the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, by saying Jesus does these two things. Number one, he demonstrates compassion, right? He goes and he heals those with physical ailments, the deaf, the blind, the mute, the demon-possessed. He deals with people's emotional lives and seeks healing there as well. The woman at the well, you've had 5 husbands and the man you're now with isn't your husband. He doesn't avoid that kind of pain either, because he wants to take all forms of suffering out of circulation. But Jesus isn't only compassionate, he is also perfectly and absolutely wise. You ever wondered why the temptation narratives come in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And I think actually Jesus is tempted throughout John's gospel in the same ways that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why is the first thing that happens to Jesus when he enters into his public ministry is that he's thrust into the desert for 40 days? Israel was in the desert for 40 years. Now Jesus is thrust by the Spirit of God into the desert where he would suffer deprivation of various kinds for 40 days and 40 nights. What's going on there? Well, maybe Jesus is being given the opportunity to be tempted just as Israel was and see if his appetite of priorities are straight. Is that what's going on? Well, it certainly seems like it. In one of the most understated statements in the entire Bible, Matthew tells us, Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and then Jesus was hungry. I mean, I would find it really hard not to put, he was absolutely famished and starving, and every grasshopper that jumped by, he wanted to eat it. Like, he was totally famished. The devil comes to him and says, yeah, well, you know what? If you're really the Son of God, i.e., if you are truly God's new Israel in the world, then turn these stones into bread. And Jesus says, I will not do it. I will not, because I see that this test is a test from God. And I'm not going to eject myself out of the test, cutting off my relationship with God, the source of all life and all love and all wisdom, in order to deal with my ravenous appetite at the moment. He won't do it. Luke says this. This is really great. You know what Luke says at the end of his temptation narrative? The devil left Jesus until an opportune time. And you go, what? The temptation of Jesus wasn't done? No, it wasn't done. And especially as Jesus makes his way to the cross and the passion, every form of suffering known to human beings is thrown at Jesus. Hard forms, emotional dislocation, betrayal from a friend, denial from a friend. He is placed in one of the most shameful positions that a human being can be placed in. Not only the physical suffering of the cross, but it is singularly a tool of shaming somebody and saying, you think you are somebody, you are a nobody. You cross Rome, Rome crosses you, you are done. And do you think Jesus ever cuts off his relationship with God? No, the devil tempts him with everything. Maybe this form of suffering will make him give up on God and not fulfill the task he's come to do, which is what? To deal with the suffering of the world. He won't do it. He will not cut it off. And so think about it this way. As Jesus goes to the cross, he's like a pincushion for suffering. Every form of suffering known to human beings is thrown at Jesus when he's on the cross, and he's on his way to the cross. And he absorbs it, and he absorbs it, and he absorbs it. But he never cuts off his relationship from the source of all other forms of suffering, right? It's Adam and Eve's mistrust of God that brings in this floodwork of suffering into the world. Jesus never does that. And thereby, the gospel writers tell us in the New Testament say, he has indeed dealt with the problem of suffering in the world. He's absorbed it like a pincushion into himself. And then, holding on to the source of life, he becomes that source of life for the world. As I've said from this pulpit several times, John displays this so graphically and beautifully that when the Roman soldier spears Christ, blood and water flow out. Here is the source of life for the world now. Paul in 1 Corinthians says, the rock in the desert was Christ. How can he say that? Because Christ is the source of every single form of life. When you drink water today, that is Christ. You are drinking of the Son of God himself. Why? Because he provides it. When we stand before the cross and we receive the forgiveness of sins from the one who's taken suffering out of circulation, we are drinking of Christ. He has done it. Why did Jesus need to come and suffer and die and rise again? To fulfill the vocation of Israel. And he has done it. Suffering has been taken out of circulation. As shown in the resurrection of Jesus, new creation has broken into this world, as Deb said during part of the liturgy this morning. New creation has broken into this world. The job of the church today is to actualize what Christ has accomplished on the cross. In other words, we're to join him in taking more of the suffering out of circulation to make it real in this world, to be a plausibility structure for what happened on the cross. You can look at it that way, perhaps. The first and most important part of doing this is, of course, keeping God at the heart and center of our lives and never divorcing ourselves from the source of life, or when we do, to run back and to receive again the arms of the prodigal father who says, come, I've been waiting for you to come home and to give you life, life, and life in abundance. I think the challenge for us today is this. Maybe each of us can challenge ourselves to evaluate ourselves at the end of every day as individuals, okay? Have I done something today to alleviate some of the suffering of this world? It's like you want meaning in your life, here's some meaning. Try to make the world a little bit better. It does not have to be heroic. It could be in your relationship with your spouse. It could be in your relationship with a sibling. It could be by offering somebody a cold drink, just to alleviate some of the suffering of the world. And us as a church, do we remember that this is what we are here for? To worship God, to point the world to the source of all light, all love, all life, and at the same time, and thereby, to take away the suffering of the world.